This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
The newest propaganda war. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
The government is trying yet another tactic to outsmart terrorists online, a paid ad campaign in disguise. We'll explain how it works.
Still looking to cut the cord from your cable company? We'll tell you the most powerful option on the market.
To ease the stress of war, Syrians turn to board games for an escape. Find out which one.
And the reasons why TV drama writers obsess over the city of Chicago.
There's a lot of production expertise in Chicago and some actual big studio setups here, and it's less crowded in terms of shoots than it is New York or LA is, so a lot of producers find it a really good city to work in, and you know, obviously a major city with a lot of great stories and a history to tell too.
Wall Street Journal entertainment writer John Jurgensen on why Chicago is the basis for so many television shows. He's here later in the hour. The State Department is out with another tactic to try to outmaneuver ISIS terrorists when it comes to internet propaganda. Part of a paid ad campaign, videos are turning up on millions of cell phones and computer screens in countries known to be top recruiting grounds for the Islamic State. The ads offer a harrowing view of life inside the self-proclaimed caliphate, sometimes with photos or cartoons, and often in the words of refugees and defectors who warn others to stay away. It's a story by Joby Warrick, national security reporter for The Washington Post. Joby, what do we have here?
Well, you know, it's interesting. For the longest time, people have been frustrated over the fact that we can't seem to have an answer to these jihadis when they get online. We see all this terrible stuff on the internet, but we can't seem to get it off. We can't seem to challenge it effectively. So this is a new approach, and it all kind of boils down to finding the young jihadis where they live, which is on social media, on Facebook, and essentially trying to present messages that are counter to what they're getting from ISIS.
All right, so explain, what's the new approach?
So it's some commercial companies have tried things similar to this online. It's kind of like when you go on Facebook and you're shopping for something, suddenly you get hit by advertisements from related companies. They kind of know that you're interested in this subject, and they come looking for you. And now the State Department's doing the same thing. So if you're a kid in Tunisia, for example, and you're looking up jihadist stuff online, looking at ISIS videos, you're liking them on your Facebook account, suddenly in your Facebook you're getting these ads, and they have a very anti-ISIS message. Some are very clever, cartoons, drawings, illustrations, testimony from defectors, all of it with a very anti-ISIS message. It shows up whether you want it to or not. It just pops up in your Facebook feed.
So how do they do it?
So it's kind of clever. So they set up this company. It's really fairly small, and it's not a company, actually. It's just a unit within the State Department. It has a former corporate CEO who runs it, a guy who's a Navy SEAL, gets things done. And he's got a bunch of young 20s and 30-somethings who essentially have set this thing up. And they troll Facebook for all this personal browsing data that you can get if you're an advertiser. And they harness that data to try to find an audience, and then to try to craft an ad that will appeal to them. And they can test in real time if people are watching it or not, how many seconds they're watching it, and so they can refine it as they go along so they get more and more sophisticated with their messaging.
Wow. I know that efforts in the past have failed here, Joby. What makes it different this time?
Yeah, so in the past, some of the stuff we did was kind of clumsy. First of all, it typically had U.S. government on it, so State Department or whoever the author was. It tended to be, in one case, kind of a parody of ISIS. We tried to be clever and cute, and it just wasn't effective. Sometimes the messages are too long. They tend to be in English. And so the whole idea here is to get messages that work, and almost in every case they're in local languages, and they never say anything about the U.S. government being sponsor of it, because that's not just ineffective, but it becomes propaganda for the other side.
We're speaking with Joby Warrick, national security reporter for The Washington Post, also author of a book called Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS. His piece in the Post is called How a U.S. Team Uses Facebook and Guerrilla Marketing to Peel Off Potential ISIS Recruits. Do we have evidence that this is working?
That's always the hard part, because if you try to change opinion, you know, if you're an advertiser, you can measure how many products you sell. If you're trying to change minds about a terrorist group, you can see that recruits are going down. It is true that ISIS is losing support, but there are all kinds of reasons for that. So all they really have is evidence that people are watching. They have something like 14 million hits for these ads they're putting up, and that's a four-month campaign that mostly was in just three countries, so they see it as being a very promising start, and they're really just getting started.
Mm. I think you mentioned that the guy who started this was part of the Obama administration and has since stepped down. So what now for this program?
Yeah, and that's kind of the big question, because everything is being reexamined now. The Trump folks want to figure out how to fight ISIS, and they're not exactly sure what they're going to do yet. And so it's all being reviewed. You know, if the program is effective, arguably it's something that they should continue, and there's some support for it in Congress. So we'll just have to wait and see what they decide to do in the next few months.
Very good. And how long has the program been around at this point?
Only for 4 months in the sense of the Facebook stuff. They've been in business since March of last year, so it's still quite new. And so it's really, really in the test phase. They just recently went from three countries to 12, and they're scattered across the Middle East, Africa, and even in the European countries now.
Was it was the key here, Joby, finding a guy from outside of government to do this?
Sometimes it's what it takes, because government tends to be slow and sometimes a little bit halting, and its response is not as nimble as the private sector can be. And this guy is a former CEO, so he's used to working across agencies, but he's also a guy with industry pedigree, so he was able to, you know, find people from different parts of industry and different parts of government and put them all together in one room and say, get it done, and it seems to be working.
How big is the unit, would they tell you?
So there's only about 70 altogether, and the ones that are actually working on the Facebook program is only 8. So these are tiny operations. They cost not much at all, a few thousand dollars to buy ads, and yet they're managing to get a lot of traction. And that kind of shows what you can do if you have a smart idea.
Nice, Joby. Joby Warrick, national security reporter for The Washington Post. It's 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. There's a new effort afoot by therapists and other medical groups to use texting as a way to help people get mental health therapy when the patient would like to remain anonymous. While the approach has good intentions, USA Today digital ethics columnist Stephen Petro says security was his concern after he tried one out. Stephen, take us through this.
I was fighting some depression myself last fall, and so I had gotten an ad on my Facebook page for this new app. It was called Talkspace, and it was very alluring. It said that you could have a private therapist, you could do it all by text, it was secure, and if I signed up that day, it would be $30 off the usual monthly fee. So I thought, well, this sounds good. And in many ways, I think the concept of these mental health apps are good, because people who don't have access normally to good therapy can often find it this way. It is less expensive, and some people want to remain anonymous and not sit face-to-face with someone. So, you know, perhaps someone who's been sexually assaulted or someone who's coming out of the closet. So lots of positive reasons for them, but my experience over a month and then the research that I did kind of showed me they're not ready for prime time yet for a number of reasons. And, you know, the primary reason to me was they're not 100% secure, even though the marketing language said that this particular one was. There are lots of ways to breach it. The app that I was using, my therapist told me there had been a breach recently. And, you know, talking about private information, there's probably nothing more personal than, you know, what's going on in your head and what you might share with a therapist. So I really did not like the idea that someone could hack into that and spread it all over the place.
Right. All right. So in terms of the face-to-face, say, therapy appointment, how did it match up? Or how is it maybe positioned that it might match up?
Well, great question. And that was one of my first questions, too. It's like the $64,000 question. And I was told that it matches up or it exceeds face-to-face therapy. But you know, my experience is only the experience of one. And you know, we could talk to a couple of others, which I did. The science is not yet in. There are more studies being done to show how effective it may be or not, but it's not there yet. And in part, that's because this is a young, it's a young business, model, and in part, it may be that the science isn't there, that texting does not work as well as face-to-face. But, you know, the bottom line is we don't know yet. And the other problem with these apps, and there are about 25,000 of them, is that there are no regulations. So you can pretty much say whatever you want, and consumers really need to beware. And the great thing that I learned was that the American Psychiatric Association devised this mental health app tool that consumers can download, and it basically gives you 10 questions to ask to see whether the app is going to be a good one. And I really recommend that. It's easy to find online. APA Mental Health App Tool.
We're speaking with Stephen Petro, digital ethics columnist at USA Today. He's got a fascinating piece called Text-Based Therapy, Not Ready for Prime Time. So the therapist that you exchange texts with, do you know the therapist name or not even? Or because that would seem strange to me. Like, how do you address this person then? I mean, like, it seems,
I don't know, he's a dividing wall or something. I was told her name. She told me her name. I was able to check her out online.
Oh, okay.
And make sure that her credentials, you know, matched what I was told, because this particular service that I was using said very clearly in its terms of service that they do not guarantee anything about the therapist. So I'd had to do my own independent research, and she checked out fine.
Okay.
And she was very good. So I do want to say that. You know, I had a good experience with her, but I still remain concerned that, you know, our private exchanges could be leaked or hacked. And
sure.
That was kind of a problem for me.
So the takeaway here after I'm reading it is a great idea, has promise, still has kinks that need to be worked out.
Exactly. And I think the last point is, you know, when you're looking at app ratings, according to the APA, having 5 stars or 4 stars, which is high, does not necessarily mean that it's a good app. So check out reviews and, you know, check out that privacy policy. It's not an interesting read, but it really will tell you what you need to know about security and who those people are that are treating you.
That's good insight. Thanks, Stephen. Stephen Petro, USA Today digital ethics columnist. It's 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Do you have a career fitness plan? In other words, when was the last time you updated your professional profile? Well, the time is now. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
It's easy to go to work and do the same thing every day, but if you want to advance your career, you might need to think bigger. Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal is here with some advice on how to take a more active role in your professional life. Sue, why should we develop a better long-range career plan?
Well, it's only human nature to procrastinate on planning. It can be challenging and difficult. And oftentimes we get kind of stuck with inertia. We get used to going to work day after day. We don't really think about what lies ahead. Sometimes it takes a bomb dropping, like a layoff or your boss turns sour on you, to get you going, to think about, is this really what I should be doing with my life right now?
How do you know if you're not really in the right job?
That can be hard to tell. I think it's better to think about whether you're doing your job in the right way. Do you feel stuck in the job that's too limiting? Are you procrastinating on planning? Have you just stopped working on letting people know who you are and what you're doing, or letting your reputation or your network kind of stagnate? Those are things that tell you that, you know, either you're not working hard enough on planning ahead, or perhaps you are in the wrong job. Both of those can be true.
Sue, how can you make changes in the job that you already have to enhance your career?
It's interesting. Some people are able to find a way to include more of what they like in their current job, maybe to take on a little extra project to, and fit that in around the edges, do a little less of what they don't like, maybe ask for new roles or temporary assignments. And that can help you figure out whether you're in the right place. Oftentimes we discover new passions when we're trying something new or learning a new skill. So you can do it on your current job.
How do you learn to sell yourself for the next position?
Working on your personal brand is talked about a lot these days. It sounds shallow and kind of commercial, but actually all that means is keeping your reputation up to date, letting people know what you're working on. It can be a casual thing, you know, go out to lunch with somebody and say, what are you working on? Or, you know, or tell somebody what you're learning. Maybe you just learned a new skill or you're working on a certification. And keep your network alive. By some people just make a point of every month or every 2 weeks, they go out with somebody new to lunch or for coffee. or after work. And I think this helps you kind of be open to new ideas, new opportunities. It's reciprocal. It's a two-way street. You can help other people as well this way.
We're speaking with Sue Schellenbarger of the Wall Street Journal on how to take a more active role in your own professional life. Why is it important to take small steps or set small goals for yourself?
Because taking big ones is just too daunting. I think it's important to not try to map out a 20-year plan, especially in today's job market, which changes so fast. But just to try thinking about the next new thing you might want to learn, or maybe you're thinking about trying a new kind of work, put yourself out there for a freelance gig and see how that goes. Keep a career journal so you don't forget stories about things that worked well or your accomplishments, and so you're ready when someone maybe calls you for that interview in 24 hours, you'll be ready to take it and seize a new opportunity. And practice telling your other people what you're learning, what you're most interested in, keeping your reputation up to date.
You talked about freelance work. What about volunteer positions? Does that sometimes lead to something better?
One of my favorite examples in this story was of a woman who was a career teacher and never thought of changing, and she was encouraged by friends to do marketing for a philanthropic group in the community. She loved it so much that it began to distract her from her everyday job, and her mind was wandering onto the marketing task. She then turned to freelancing and discovered it really could be a vocation for her. So sometimes non-paying volunteer work is one of the best ways to find a new passion.
This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Looking for the perfect wine to bring to a party or have for a nice dinner at home? Cameron Hughes always delivers. You'll be happy with the selection for sure, and your friends will be impressed. Cameron Hughes has relationships with high-end wineries all over the world, where he sources his wine from their extra bottles and sells it directly to you for much less than you'd pay under other labels. His wines deliver on price, value, and quality. If you're unhappy with any bottle you buy from him, he'll make it right. Now, Cameron Hughes doesn't typically offer discounts because his prices are so much less than retail. But for my listeners, he has a fantastic deal on your first order of three or more bottles. Free shipping on that order, plus a free sommelier-grade corkscrew. It's a great way to try wines that are already up to 50% off. It's a no-brainer to try Cameron Hughes wine, only if you go to chwine.com and use my code DEAL at checkout. You have to go to chwine.com, chwine.com, shop for your wine, enter my code DEAL at checkout. Don't wait. It's a limited-time offer and won't last. Glad you could be with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, the most powerful option on the market for cord cutters. Also, why TV writers obsess over the city of Chicago. And where Syrians turn to ease the stress of war. It's a board game. We'll explain which one in about 20 minutes. Well, travel safety tips, normally focused on advising about crimes such as theft, have now centered on how to protect yourself during more violent episodes like a terrorist attack or hostage situation. For example, how would you react if a kidnapper took your travel group and then asked, "Someone's going to die. Who wants to die today?" Here's a sample of the training some travelers are receiving from Wall Street Journal travel editor Scott McCartney. Scott, explain.
Well, I think there's a lot of concern among travelers that that travel is in some ways getting more dangerous. That travelers themselves, whether for business or leisure, are venturing farther afield into developing countries, into places that where they're seeking adventure and other things, and there can be more local dangers. And the other part of it is that we've seen terrorism and shootings pop up in Paris or Brussels or Fort Lauderdale or lots of different places. And so I think the idea is that the old, trusted travel tips that we've all spouted for a long time need refreshing and updating. Mm-hmm. And a lot of corporations are sending their frequent travelers off to some pretty serious, rigorous training for emergencies.
Wow. And, I thought it was interesting because we hear about some of this training on campuses, for example, where it talks about, there's a phrase they use, and it's something like, hide first and protect yourself and maybe fight last or something like that. But in this, I noticed in your story, some of these teach people actually how to spot trouble beforehand.
Right, and this could be simple pickpockets, this could be kidnapping attempts, it runs the gamut. But the interesting thing is that people think of things that happen and, well, they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And it turns out the security experts say that's not the case at all. More than likely, somebody was following you, somebody was watching, you were being surveilled before your pocket got picked or whatever worse happened. Your hotel room got robbed, you got abducted, you ended up in a hostage situation. There are a whole lot of dangers, but the notion that your behavior can dictate whether you're a victim or not is really a pretty serious thing for travelers. So it can be as simple as how you walk down the street. They teach people to walk purposefully and attentively, not kind of sauntering down the boulevard with your face in your phone.
Sure.
That makes you more of a target than somebody who looks like they're aware of their surroundings.
All right, so explain some of the basics here, maybe, if that hasn't worked for you or you haven't followed along, and say you're in the situation already, kidnapping or terror attack or pickpocket, something like that.
Well, you mentioned the shooter training. It was interesting to me that the training for a kidnapping hostage situation is 180 degrees opposite from training for an active shooter situation. So in a shooter situation, get out, hide out, or take out, and in that order. The most important thing to remember is run as fast as you can. And that's counter to how people typically react. Typically in these things, people freeze, and that's deadly for a lot of people. You've got to overcome that fear and run. If you can't get out, hide out, which means barricade yourself in a bathroom, in a closet, or whatever. And if you can't do either of those, get with a group of people and try and rush the attacker. The strategy for an abduction is different. You want to be calm. You want to connect, and then you want to capitalize. And that theory is in those situations, the most dangerous time are the initial minutes. The abductors are usually, scared themselves, anxious, crazed, whatever, and volatile. And so you want to lower your profile as much as possible. You want to do all you can to agree and cooperate and calm the situation. And then when you get a chance, you want to connect with the captors, find out what their problem is, how can you help them, that kind of stuff. And then if you get the chance, you look for a way to capitalize either with an escape attempt or more likely with getting them to let you make a phone call, do what you can to try and arrange a resolution.
Thanks, Scott. Wall Street Journal travel editor Scott McCartney. It's 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for joining us. Have you wanted to cut the cord with your cable company but haven't found the right way to do it? Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group, says the NVIDIA Shield TV 2017 is the new and best way to free yourself. Rob, what do you make of it?
Well, so NVIDIA came out with Shield TV last year. So they just refreshed it with the 2017 Shield. It's now connected to a lot of 4K content, including Amazon Prime. So now if you've got a new 4K TV, and I shouldn't say just 4K, that last year's was 4K, this year's is 4K plus HDR. And in many ways, HDR, high dynamic range, is more important than 4K, because high dynamic range works with pretty much any size TV, where 4K is really best when you've got a really big TV and you're sitting pretty close.
Yeah, okay.
High dynamic range, it gives you those deep blacks, those bright colors, and regardless of the size of the set, that's brilliant on everything. So okay. So now you got a new TV, and a lot of folks bought new TVs for the Super Bowl, and it's HDR and it's 4K, and there's no HDR 4K programming. Well, this gives you 4K and HDR programming. So the end result is you got a bunch of streaming services that provide HDR and 4K. Amazon and Netflix now, for some of the programs, are supporting HDR and 4K, and it supports that, and it supports both those services. And so the end result is you finally have a set-top box that, when tied to your new HDR 4K TV, will make that HDR 4K TV thing. So otherwise, you're paying for a bunch of technology you're not getting.
Yeah, yeah. We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle. He's written a piece called The NVIDIA Shield TV 2017, The Most Powerful Option for Cord Cutters. All right, so let's revisit this issue that comes up every now and then. Your take on why more people have not cut the cord.
Well, habit, I think, for the most part. You get in the habit of watching shows when you watch them. I mean, I'm a TiVo user myself for the most part, and so I record the shows as they happen, and I watch them whenever I want. Much better, though, as you move across, is you just pay for the show that you want to watch, and then you watch it that way. The end result is you don't get commercials. So I know when I binge watch, for instance, we were binge watching Game of Thrones, which is commercial free to begin with. But you pay for it, so you watch it all the way through. And we did six seasons in a month and a half.
Jeez.
But the end result is no commercials. You get to see the program, every program all the way through, and until you finish it, you watch them wherever you want. But people aren't used to it. It didn't come up that way. Now, the folks that are cutting cords pretty aggressively are kids. As the kids come into market, as they start buying their own TVs, they're not really buying cable services except for networking. And the end result is pretty much everything they're watching is either off the web or from one of these services, and they're used to just getting the stuff when they want it. And a lot of that stuff is coming, except for Hulu, which still gives you commercials that you can't get rid of.
Yeah.
Gives it to you commercial free, and so you're not watching commercials. You're able to watch the programming, and they love it. So I think it's a habit thing. For those of us, particularly boomers, that came up with TV the way it is, we just have a hard time cutting the cord.
Yeah.
Do be aware, though, there are a couple things that just don't work all that way for cord cutters. News is kind of iffy. You have to bring it down off the web if you want to do it. And the other thing is sports.
Yeah,
if you want to watch live sports, yeah, you can do it with a cord cutting box, but it's been kind of iffy. The blackout areas and the surfaces that handle the individual sports are a little uneven at the moment.
Yeah.
But everything else, you can pretty much get off of an internet service or watch whenever you want.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, president and principal of the Enderle Group, the tech advisory firm. It's 13 minutes now in front of the hour. On This Weekend, transition seamlessly from presentation to meeting and from work to home with the Dell Latitude 13 7000 series, the laptop that takes care of business. The powerful performance and incredible battery life from this reliable business-class PC featuring Intel Core processors lets small business employees do their best work wherever work takes them. Learn more at Dell.com/radio. That's Dell.com/radio. Chicago Hope theme to set up this next story. You've heard the ugly numbers from Chicago regarding shootings and killings. On TV, grim facts are colliding with fiction in a number of dramas. Set in a city under national scrutiny because of its bloodshed, 51 people were murdered in Chicago last month. One more than in January of 2016, the start of the city's most violent year in two decades. Just this past week, three children were shot, two of them fatally. Wall Street Journal reporter John Jurgensen has a look at how fact and fiction are mixing here. John, what have you found?
It's really sort of an interesting coincidence in the entertainment industry that Chicago has become such a focus. Part of that just has to do with economics. I mean, Illinois offers a tax credit. There's a lot of production expertise in Chicago and some actual big studio setups here. And it's less crowded in terms of shoots than it is New York or L.A. is. So a lot of producers find it a really good city to work in. Obviously a major city with a lot of great stories and the history to tell, too. So you have that set up, which has brought a lot of shows here, kind of colliding with the fact that, you know, the city, for a lot of really terrible reasons, is in the center of the news a lot lately, too, specifically because of the murder statistics in the city. So you have a lot of these producers trying to reconcile what they're doing on their TV shows with what's actually happening in reality on the streets of the city.
Can you just name a handful of these Chicago-named or themed TV shows?
Well, one you can, on one hand, and take up almost all the fingers on one hand, name the Dick Wolf franchise shows that have sprung up here, starting about, well, what, 5 years ago with Chicago Fire, that gave way to Chicago PD, then Chicago Med came, and in March we get Chicago Justice. So that's four shows produced by one company that all sort of cross over and mingle with each other in terms of characters and storylines. You have on Fox a show called APB, which is about, you know, sort of a high-tech a billionaire who takes over a police precinct in this city. That's a new one. And then you have another one coming up in the, well, it doesn't have a premiere date yet, but on Showtime you have a show called The Chi, which is more of a sort of a grittier pay cable look at what's happening on the south side of Chicago. That's coming in the future.
Wow.
To name a few. And then there's lots of shows that shoot here and are set here that don't have much to do with crime, but certainly have the city as their setting.
All right, so the crime theme then, how does it sit with residents in Chicago?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I reached out to a lot of people locally to talk about these shows, and you have kind of a mixed bag. You know, some people, it's on their radar, what's happening on TV. Other people tend to ignore it and, you know, just watch their Netflix or whatever. So it's not as if the whole city's watching these shows and embracing them as kind of local fare necessarily.
Thanks, John. John Jurgensen, Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter. It's 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. Nothing like a board game to ease the stress of war. Created in 1957, Risk is becoming a favorite diversion among some Syrians who see their country's intractable conflict mirrored in the game's competition for global domination. Story from the Wall Street Journal. As you may know, Risk pits multiple armies against each other in a fight to seize territory, make and break alliances, and rely on reinforcements for survival. How apt, the journal says, in the Syrian conflict, an anti-government revolution 6 years ago, morphed into a multi-sided conflict killing more than 400,000 people. The flags of the warring parties in Syria correspond closely to team colors in the game. With only five colors, though, Risk cannot entirely capture the complexity of the actual war. The journal says Syrians play a simplified version of their own conflict, with few references to the foreign powers, such as the U.S., Russia, and Turkey, that have turned it into a proxy war. The only smoke, the journal says, hanging over the game board is the pall from a hookah pipe. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.